From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Are you prepared to recommend to the president that we close Guantanamo?
I'm prepared to recommend to the president that we take the responsible course in dealing with the people at Guantanamo. I can't simply say we have to close Guantanamo because obviously the question then arises of what we do with the people who were there, and there is now no easy solution to that.
Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee will play excerpts and speak with Michael Ratner, head of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And what would you do if your country was invaded?
Suppose Iraq invaded America, and an Iraqi soldier was on a tank passing through an American street, waving his gun at the people, threatening them, raiding and trashing houses. Would you accept that? This is why no Iraqi can accept the occupation. Don't be surprised by their reactions. Their attitudes are normal.
Meeting Resistance is a new documentary on the insurgency in Iraq. We'll speak with filmmakers Steve Connors and Molly Bingham. Bingham was kidnapped by insurgents in 2003. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic and Republican leaders in the Senate have reached a deal with the Bush administration that would grant retroactive immunity to major telecommunications firms that have aided the spying on U.S. citizens without court warrant. The measure would wipe out a series of pending lawsuits against the companies for alleged violations of privacy rights. Senate Democrats won a requirement that would allow the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to review the government's procedures for deciding who is to be the subject of warrantless spying. The measure would also face renewal every 6 years instead of being made permanent. Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey appears headed for Senate approval following his first day of confirmation hearings. On Wednesday, Mukasey defended many of President Bush's most controversial post-9/11 policies. He said the president has the right to indefinitely detain American citizens without charge. He refused to recommend the closing of the military prison at Guantanamo, and Mukasey said he doesn't believe prisoners at Guantanamo should be allowed the right of habeas corpus. Meanwhile, Mukasey was harshly critical of a 2002 Justice Department memo on torture, which he described as, quote, worse than a sin. We'll have more on Mukasey's confirmation hearings after headlines. President Bush has escalated the rhetoric in a standoff with Iran by warning of a World War III unless Iran curb its nuclear ambitions.
So I've told people that if you're interested in avoiding World War III, it seems like you ought to be interested in preventing them from having the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon. And I take the threat of Iran with a nuclear weapon very seriously, and we'll continue to work with all nations about the seriousness of this threat.
Bush's comments came hours after Iranian officials announced Russia had put forth an undisclosed new proposal to end the nuclear standoff. The Bush administration has insisted Iran halt nuclear enrichment as a precondition to talks. Iran says it opened to talks, but without preconditions. President Bush also defended his veto of a bill expanding health insurance to millions of low-income children. He said using the veto is, quote, one way to ensure that I am relevant. The chair of the Federal Communications Commission is proposing to do away with media ownership rules that bar companies from owning both a newspaper and a television or radio station in the same city. Kevin Martin says he'll allow 1 month of public comment before the FCC puts the plan to a vote. Martin has backed a series of studies on the rules criticized for an alleged bias towards media consolidation. Gene Kimmelman, vice president of the nonprofit Consumers Union, said, quote, we will demonstrate that this is purely an ideological, politically motivated effort to allow media companies to consolidate and dominate local markets. In Turkey, the parliament has overwhelmingly approved authorization for a military offensive against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. Turkey says it has no imminent plans for an attack, but is still massing troops along the border. The Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani, warned against a Turkish incursion.
We hope that the wisdom of our friend, Prime Minister Erdogan, will be so active that there will be no military intervention, and we, Iraqi government, we are, and Kurdistan regional government, are ready to cooperate with Turkish authorities to reach agreement.
Meanwhile, in Iraq, there are new indications the private military firm Blackwater USA could be gone by the middle of next year. The Associated Press is reporting U.S. officials expect they won't renew Blackwater's contract when it expires in May. The non-renewal would fall short of an outright firing of Blackwater for the killing of at least 17 Iraqi civilians in a mass shooting last month. In Somalia, the U.N. has suspended food aid in the capital Mogadishu following the arrest of the top World Food Program official there. Idris Osman was being held overnight after dozens of armed soldiers stormed the U.N. compound. No explanation was given for his arrest. The shutdown will cut off some 75,000 people from receiving aid. New video testimony has emerged of survivors of the Burmese junta's crackdown on a popular uprising. Researchers with Amnesty International interviewed dozens of witnesses and victims along the Thai-Burma border. This is one unidentified monk's account.
Some of the injured were so bloody that you couldn't tell where the blood was coming from. Some of the monks lost the top parts of their robes. I saw civilians trying to help an injured monk. Most of their injuries were head injuries. The riot police were aiming for the head.
Chers also spoke to pro-democracy activist Klang Motan.
There are about 1,450 prisoners, and about 500 of them have head injuries. They need immediate medical attention. There wasn't sufficient medical attention. There was no drinking water, and there was no toilet. None at all. Some of the monks have been forcibly disrobed. They were given civilian clothes, but the monks didn't want to wear civilian clothes, so they remained topless. I was told the situation was really bad.
In Bolivia, hundreds of people gathered Wednesday outside the U.S. Embassy in La Paz to demand the extradition of former President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. The gathering came on the fourth anniversary of the Black October government crackdown that killed 67 protesters, wounded more than 400. The protesters had been opposing a decision by the Sanchez de Lozada government to export Bolivia's natural gas through a port in Chile. De Lozada and two former top officials have resided in the U.S. since 2003 after a citizens' uprising removed them from office. Bolivia is seeking De Lozada's extradition. This is Black October victim's attorney, Rogelio Meta.
Sanchez de Lozada is trying to make out that the trial for responsibility of the September and October 2003 massacres is a political persecution, but it isn't. This is a cause of justice, and for 4 years of justice in waiting. It is part of the fight against impunity here in Bolivia, and as we consider it, for the whole American continent.
A new study shows remittances from migrant workers to their home countries dwarfs the amount of international aid from the world's richest nations. The UN International Fund for Agricultural Development and the Inter-American Development Bank says workers sent more than $300 billion to developing nations last year. IFAD President Leonard Baige said the numbers call for easing barriers to remittances.
It's hard-earned money by poor people in rich countries sending back to their families, but it has a potential. So let's make it easy to transfer, let's make it cheap to transfer, and let's build the financial system locally so that it can really come to use in the local communities where it's destined to go.
The U.S. Supreme Court has granted a last-minute stay of execution to Virginia death row prisoner Christopher Scott Emmett. Legal experts say the move could signal a new nationwide moratorium on lethal injection. And in other news from Virginia, local officials in Prince William County have unanimously approved some of the nation's harshest restrictions on undocumented immigrants. Police will now be tasked with checking the immigration status of anyone accused of breaking the law if they believe that person is in the U.S. illegally. The Board of County Supervisors approved the measures by a vote of 8-0. More than 1,200 people showed up at the board meeting, most of them against the proposal. The new rules are already facing a court challenge from opponents who say they're unconstitutional. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Confirmation hearings began Wednesday for Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey. And after a day of questioning, the Democratic-led Senate Judiciary Committee appears set to support his confirmation. President Bush nominated Mukasey to replace Alberto Gonzalez after Gonzalez quit in August amidst a series of scandals involving the firing of U.S. attorneys and for approving a secret warrantless domestic surveillance program. Mukasey is a retired federal judge who handled several high-profile cases, including the 1995 trial of Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, the blind sheikh, and the initial detention of Jose Padilla. On Wednesday, Mukasey defended many of President Bush's most controversial post-9/11 policies. He said the president has the right to indefinitely detain American citizens without charge. He refused to recommend the closing of the military prison at Guantanamo. And Mukasey said he doesn't believe prisoners at Guantanamo should be allowed the right of habeas corpus. Meanwhile, Mukasey was harshly critical of the 2002 Justice Department memo on torture, which he described as worse than a sin. Mukasey promised to maintain independence from President Bush's White House. He told Senator Arlen Specter he would resign if he couldn't dissuade the president from taking action that he determined to be illegal. In a moment, we'll be joined by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. But first, we turn to the confirmation hearings. This is Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein questioning Michael Mukasey.
I'd like to ask a question about executive power. And in Padilla v. Bush, you upheld the president's power to detain Jose Padilla indefinitely, even though he was a United States citizen seized on United States soil without being charged with any crime. Under an existing statute, no American citizen could be detained, quote, except pursuant to an act of Congress, end quote. You ruled that the authorization for the use of military force was an act of Congress and was written broadly enough to authorize Padilla's detention. The Second Circuit disagreed, saying that the AUMF did not authorize the president to detain American citizens like Padilla, who were seized in the United States. The Supreme Court did not reach the issue, and it remains unresolved. As Attorney General, will you advise the President that the AUMF authorizes him to seize United States citizens on U.S. soil and detain them indefinitely without charge?
I think that the authority of the President to seize U.S. citizens and detain them without charge, leaving aside for a moment where that happens, was in fact sustained in Hamdi. The court in Hamdi did rule that the president had authority to, among other things, seize and detain American citizens captured on the field of battle. Of course, that person was captured in, I believe, in Afghanistan.
I'm talking about the United States.
Hamdi left open the question of where the battlefield is and who defines the battlefield. And I certainly can't say that as of now, there is clear authority authorizing what I thought there was authority to authorize in Padilla.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Also, in your Padilla opinion, you claim that under Civil War era prize cases, the president has inherent authority to respond to aggressive acts by third parties, and that, quote, courts may not review the level of force selected, end quote. First question is, how long does this unlimited power last?
I think the short answer to that is that it lasts as long as it has to last until the other political bodies involved in the matter can take the matter up and deal with it.
Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey being questioned by Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein at Wednesday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. The future of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo was also repeatedly brought up during the hearing. This is a question from Democratic Senator Herb Kohl of Wisconsin, followed by questions from Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Democrat Dick Durbin of Illinois. Senator Herb Kohl.
Are you prepared to recommend to the president that we close Guantanamo?
I'm prepared to recommend to the president that we take the responsible course in dealing with the people at Guantanamo. I can't simply say we have to close Guantanamo because obviously the question then arises of what we do with the people who were there, and there is now no easy solution to that.
Would you advise the president of the United States to allow unlawful enemy combatants to have habeas rights, to grant them habeas corpus rights at Guantanamo Bay?
I would not advise the president to grant rights beyond those that they already have.
I also asked you about Guantanamo. You referred to it, a colorful phrase, you referred to it as a, quote, a fright wig. used by critics of the administration, and defended Guantanamo on the grounds that detainees received, quote, three hots and a cot, health care better than many Americans, and taxpayer-funded Korans. That's what you said when we met. What I heard in response to your questions from Senator Cole is that that may not accurately characterize your feelings about Guantanamo.
My feelings about Guantanamo as a place, which I have not visited, I admit I have not visited it, but I have spoken to people who have, is, my feeling is, pretty much what I told you in a rather pungent conversational way. I don't think people are mistreated there. That is not to say that the problem of indefinite detention of a large number of people has not become a problem for us. It is a problem for us. It's an ongoing problem. We've got to get our hands around it and resolve it. And it's due, as I indicated before, in large measure to the fact that getting ownership of that problem is a difficult thing in government. I recognize that.
I suppose mistreatment is a matter of interpretation. If one is speaking of torture of the Guantanamo detainees, that is one category of mistreatment for sure. Detention without due process may be another category of mistreatment that Senator Specter's addressed, along with Senator Leahy, on the issue of habeas corpus. Would you concede that holding these detainees without charges for years, and then in many cases releasing them without charges, is a form of mistreatment?
What one regards conversationally as mistreatment or not, I think, is probably in the eye of the beholder. As under Hamdi, it is lawful. Hamdi said, as far as I know, unequivocally, that it is lawful for the president to detain people, even Americans, captured on a field of battle, indefinitely.
Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey responding to questions from Senators Dick Durbin, Lindsey Graham, and Herb Kohl. Talk more about the Mukasey nomination. Attorney Michael Ratner joins us. He's president of the Center for Constitutional Rights here in New York City. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Nice to see you, Amy.
Your response.
Well, my response is, I think we all know who Mukasey is. Mukasey is someone who basically isn't willing to take on the torture program, Guantanamo, electronic surveillance, enemy combatants, all these issues that have been the core of the U.S. going off the page of fundamental rights. He is sadly off the page with the administration. And the real question to me of this whole charade, which is what I have to call that hearing, is the fact that the Democrats are willing to confirm him and basically lay down and let issues like enemy combatants, torture, electronic surveillance simply be continued by the next attorney general. So it's really, when I watched the hearings yesterday, to me it was one of the saddest days I've seen in that Congress. And the only thing I could think of was the sign that Dante wanted in front of the gates of hell, which is, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. We can go through each of these issues, but for example, on torture, they're lauding Mukasey, these Democrats, because he says he won't torture people, he doesn't believe in torture. Well, you have to ask yourself, what's the difference between what he's saying and President Bush is saying? Every government that engages in torture says we don't torture. The question is, how do you define torture? And on those issues, they did not take him on. They didn't ask him, is waterboarding torture? Is it used in combination with temperature control, with stripping, with hooding? Is that torture? No one asked him that.
Well, let's go back to the clip of the confirmation hearing on the issue of torture. This is Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
I think one of the greatest stains on the history of this country is a memo dated August 1st, 2002, signed by then Assistant Attorney General Jay Bybee. It concluded that the president has authority as commander-in-chief to override domestic and international laws prohibiting torture, to immunize anybody who commits torture, immunize them from prosecution. And many of us voted against Alberto Gonzalez's nomination for attorney general because he refused to disavow legal conclusions in a memo that did not rule out the use of cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment of detainees during interrogations. Turns out that our concerns are well-founded. New York Times recently reported that soon after Attorney General Gonzalez took over, the Department of Justice secretly endorsed combinations of the harshest interrogation tactics as legal, even though they'd been publicly withdrawn under the so-called Bybee memo. Now, do you believe, so we know where you might stand on this, do you believe that the president has the authority under any circumstances to exercise a so-called commander-in-chief override and immunize acts of torture, as the Bybee memo argued?
We are parties to a treaty that outlaws torture. Torture is unlawful under the laws of this country. The president has said that in an executive order. But beyond all of those legal restrictions, we don't torture not simply because it's against this or that law or against this or that treaty. It is not what this country is about. It is not what this country stands for. It's antithetical to everything this country stands for. Soldiers of this country liberated concentration camps toward the end of World War II and at the end of World War II and photographed what they saw there as a record of what the barbarism that we oppose. We didn't do that so that we could then duplicate it ourselves. The Bybee memo, to paraphrase a French diplomat, was worse than a sin. It was a mistake. It was unnecessary. It, as I've read, I mean, I've read the memo and I've read some of what's been written about it. It purported to justify measures based on broad grants of authority that were unnecessary. The analysis in that memo was found to be defective, and the memo was withdrawn in favor of a later memo that narrowed substantially the basis for authorizing measures beyond, perhaps different from, those that may be contained in the Army Field Manual.
Would you, would it be a safe characterization of what you've just said, that you repudiate this memo as not only being contrary to law, but also contrary to the values America stands for?
I do.
Okay. And is there such a thing as a commander-in-chief override that would allow the immunization of acts of torture that violate the law?
Not that I'm aware of.
That was Michael Mukasey responding to Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy of Vermont. Michael Ratner.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand what Mukasey is saying here. He's saying basically that I don't agree with the memo to the extent it says the president as commander-in-chief can do whatever he wants to human beings. He's not saying that the part of the memo that defines torture as organ failure and the definitions of torture also is illegal or unconstitutional. So he's giving them something with one hand, but on the other hand, he's not saying that the actual techniques used, which are waterboarding and the like, or this issue that needs to be torture, needs to be organ failure, he's not saying those are illegal. So the next question that Leahy should have said, well, what do you think of waterboarding? What do you think of chaining to the floor? What do you think of stripping?
And what would the role of the Attorney General be on these issues if Mukasey does become the Attorney General?
You know, every single legal memo, basically, that justified torture, Guantanamo, renditions, every single legal memo comes out of the Attorney General's office. His role would be to take and basically destroy those memos, issue new memos, putting us back on the page of law. But no one in that hearing is insisting on that. In fact, when he was actually pushed on a little bit about torture by one of the senators, he said, what you characterize as torture, I do not know of such a policy. Think about that. Every American who's thinking, who reads the newspapers, knows that this is a country of torture right now. And these memos came out in 2005 after Congress supposedly banned cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. They write memos saying you can still waterboard and use these various techniques in combination. The question is he an ostrich? Where's this guy living? And so what we're getting here is we're getting someone who's on the same page as this administration on most of the issues we should be concerned about.
Let's go back to the hearing. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, asking Mukasey about the Bush administration's warrantless domestic surveillance program.
Attorney General Gonzalez apparently believes the president has a commander-in-chief override for many of the laws of this country, which contribute to the violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, so-called FISA, the signing statement of reservation, and others. For 5 years, the administration conducted a program of warrantless surveillance that violated the provisions of FISA. They didn't come to us and ask us for changes, even though this Congress has almost unanimously updated and changed FISA more than 30 times since it was first enacted to take into consideration changes in technology and needs. Only after somebody in the administration leaked to the press that this was going on, and the resultant public criticism, and telecommunication companies that cooperated were sued, did they come back and say, maybe we ought to look at a new law? Do you believe that the president has authority to override something that is in law, legal requirements, and immunize illegal surveillance on Americans?
President can't immunize illegality. That's a contradiction in terms. But that said, I think there's a long, complex history to the FISA statute, beginning with its passage in 1978, when the then Attorney General, Jimmy Carter's Attorney General, Griffin Bell, took the view and expressed the view that the limits of FISA did not reach to the limits of presidential authority, which is to say that there was some gap between where FISA left off and where the Constitution permitted the president to act.
Michael Mukasey responded to questions from the Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy. Your thoughts on this issue?
Just look at what this guy is saying. They're asking him about the warrantless wiretapping program that clearly violated constitutional law, and he actually says, well, there may be a gap between the law and presidential authority that allows the president to do this warrantless surveillance. So he's essentially saying this is okay. At another point in the hearing, he said, when they talked about the electronic warrantless surveillance program, he says, quote, I'm not familiar with that program. How could someone living in today's America be not familiar with the warrantless wiretapping program? So what you're talking about here, who's somebody who is basically going to go along with this administration, give it a little better face than Gonzalez, but is essentially one of them.
Now, the top news, Democratic and Republican leaders reaching an agreement over a deal with the Bush administration over electronic surveillance that would grant retroactive immunity to the telecommunications companies that gave information over to allow the surveillance of U.S. citizens.
Yeah, I mean, look where we are, Amy. The Military Commission Act in October 2006 granted retroactive immunity on the issues of torture. And so now they're making a deal to grant retroactive immunity to the telecommunications companies because they cooperated illegally, almost for sure illegally, with the government in electronically surveilling us without warrants.
So where are the Democrats?
Where are the Democrats? Right now they're in a very, very bad place, in my view. They're not a group that we can depend on to protect fundamental rights, whether they're to do with torture, electronic surveillance, enemy combatants, and certainly not to close Guantanamo at this point. I mean, his answer on Guantanamo, this is 6 years of Guantanamo, never had anybody with a charge, and he says this is a difficult issue, what are we going to do with the people? Well, the answer is, if you have charges against people, you can try them in a regular criminal court. If you don't, they have to be released. And whose responsibility is that? That's our responsibility in the United States, and we ought to take those people into the United States. Now, Mukasey, what's amazing is you have three bodies of knowledge to look at. He's written op-eds in the Wall Street Journal. Those say, first of all, that he wants terrorist courts, special courts to try terrorists. This is the guy the Democrats are going to confirm. He attacked the National Library Association for going after the Patriot Act. This is the guy they want to confirm. Then he's a trial judge right here in the Southern District of New York. And what does he do? He upholds Jose Padilla's enemy combatant status, upholds material warrants, and in one of the most chilling, really one of the most chilling things that reminds me of every dictatorship in the world, the lawyer representing Padilla, or no, not Padilla, but brings this Palestinian, Awadallah, in front of the court. It's on a material witness warrant. It's a secret hearing. And the lawyer says, my client's been beaten. The client's in a jumpsuit, orange jumpsuit. What does Mukasey say from the bench? He looks fine to me. This is after an allegation of beating. This is the man that these Democrats want to put in as Attorney General. No excuse for it.
I want to go to the private military contractor, Blackwater. Last week, your organization, the Center for Constitutional Rights, sued Blackwater on behalf of the families of three Iraqis killed by Blackwater forces on September 16th in Baghdad. President Bush was asked about Blackwater during his news conference yesterday.
As Commander-in-Chief, are you in control of and responsible for military contractors in Iraq? And if not, who is?
Yes, I'm responsible in that the State Department has hired those military contractors.
Are you satisfied with their performance, and how, what are you doing to satisfy yourself?
I will be anxious to see the analysis of their performance. There's a lot of studying going on, both inside Iraq and out, as to whether or not people violated rules of engagement. I will tell you, though, that a firm like Blackwater provides a valuable service. They protect people's lives. And I appreciate the sacrifice and the service that the Blackwater employees have made. And they, too, want to make sure that if there's any inconsistencies or, you know, behavior that shouldn't, that ought to be modified, that we do that.
Michael Ratner, your response.
Well, you can already see the president beginning to distance himself from Blackwater, saying there's an investigation going on. You see what you said in the earlier part of the program, that the State Department is considering not renewing the contract. I think Blackwater is considering not even applying because they know they're not going to get it. And then, of course, when he says they're doing their job, yeah, if their job is to terrorize the Iraqi population, they're doing their job.
Wednesday was not the first time that President Bush was asked about Blackwater. In April of last year, President Bush spoke at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. After his talk, he took questions from students at the school.
The question is in regards to private military contractors. The Uniform Code of Military Justice does not apply to these contractors in Iraq. I asked your Secretary of Defense a couple months ago what law governs their actions.
Mr. Rumsfeld, I was going to ask him. Go ahead. Help.
Well, I was hoping your answer might be a little more specific. Mr. Rumsfeld answered that Iraq has its own domestic laws, which he assumed apply to those private military contractors. However, Iraq is clearly not currently capable of enforcing its laws, much less against, you know, over our American military contractors. I would submit to you that in this case, this is one case that privatization is not a solution. Mm. And Mr. President, how do you propose to bring private military contractors under a system of law?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I wasn't kidding. I was going to pick up the phone and say, Mr. Secretary, I got an interesting question. This is what delegation, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case, but never. I really will. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it? That's how I work.
Michael Ratner.
Well, Amy, I mean, you want to weep for America when you see that. When you see the president making a joke about Blackwater, which has been alleged to be involved in all kinds of incidents, killings, et cetera, and then the audience of press people just laughing about it, you know that this country is not in a great place. I mean, this is a private military force, essentially, operating overseas in Iraq that's been accused of all kinds of things, and they're making, including murders of Iraqi citizens, and they're making jokes about it. The president, and no less guilty, the audience of reporters who were looking at it.
Actually, the person who asked that was just a student at Johns Hopkins. Might be a lesson to some reporters on how to ask a question.
I think so, Amy.
On Sunday, Blackwater founder Eric Prince appeared on CNN. He was asked to respond to the CCR, your lawsuit. This is what he said.
First to the lawsuit, the trial lawyers that filed this lawsuit are the same guys that defended the World Trade Center bombings in 1993, the blind shake, and have defended a bunch of killers of FBI agents and other cops. So this is very much a politically motivated lawsuit for media attention.
That's Eric Prince, Michael Ratner. He's talking about CCR.
Well, obviously, I mean, this is like a transparent attempt to try and divert attention from Blackwater's actions, particularly in the September killings. Where there's many, many witnesses and much evidence that basically says no one fired on Blackwater. Blackwater just fired and killed 17 people. So that's an obvious attempt. It's barely worthy of a response because that's all that's going on. Although the killing of the two FBI agents is important to bring out because what he's speaking of there is the man who's in prison right now, Leonard Peltier, for those two killings at the reservation in South Dakota. And that Indian man is unjustly in that prison. And so that's a case that particularly is galling because you have this Indian leader who's been unjustly imprisoned for 25 years.
We'll leave it there. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, two reporters who met the resistance in Iraq, who interviewed resistance fighters in Iraq for 10 months. Stay with us.
She's far too young to die. You can see it in her eye. She's not yet begun to fly. It's time to let the mighty eagle soar once more. Let the eagle soar like she's never soared before. From rocky coast to golden shore, let the mighty soar, soar with healing in her wings, as the land beneath her sings. Only God, no other kings. Let the mighty eagle soar. She's never soared before. From rocky coast to golden shore, let the mighty eagle soar, soar with healing in her wings, as the land beneath her sings.
John Ashcroft singing Let the Eagle Soar, yes, the former Attorney General of the United States. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. What would you do if your country was invaded? Meeting Resistance is a new documentary on the Iraq War from a perspective few in the West have dared to adopt. It turns the spotlight on Iraqi men and women who choose to resist the military occupation of their country. The film takes us back to the first year of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and the beginnings of the insurgency in Iraq. This is how a young cleric interviewed in the film explains the roots of the insurgency.
Suppose Iraq invaded America, and an Iraqi soldier was on a tank passing through an American street, waving his gun at the people, threatening them, raiding and trashing houses. Would you accept that? This is why no Iraqi can accept the occupation. Don't be surprised by their reactions. Their attitudes are normal.
In Meeting Resistance, we hear the voices and stories of individuals usually simply referred to, depending on your perspective, as resistance fighters, insurgents, or terrorists. During the early years of the war, the Bush administration, the mainstream media said they were comprised of al-Qaeda elements and former Ba'ath Party members still loyal to Saddam Hussein. Today, the attacks on U.S.-led forces are often blamed on Iran and foreign fighters. But Meeting Resistance suggests that, quote, ordinary Iraqis, men and women, Sunni and Shia, form the bulk of the insurgency. Most of them never Ba'athist, nor were they all religious. This is how one of the characters interviewed in the film describes the composition of one resistance group.
This group formed spontaneously under the banner of Islam. They are engineers, officers, teachers, normal people, cultured people. Some have a medium level of education, and some have higher. All of them are committed Muslims who follow the prescribed rites of Islam. Before these events, I didn't pray. I didn't even know my way to the mosque.
In Meeting Resistance, you also hear the voice of a woman involved with the Iraqi resistance.
When I leave the house to go and bring the weapons, I feel very happy, very, very happy. But when I am actually carrying it, I'm very worried about the weapons and about myself. So I have these two feelings at the same time. I am facilitating a mission. I've done this job many, many times. Yes, now there is a kind of fear because of the many house searches. Even before I had the children, my husband was a good citizen, a patriot, a fighter. And for 29 years, I've been his wife. So even if I didn't have this patriotic instinct through our life together, this patriotic sentiment would have been created inside me. The whole family is patriotic. And how could I be so deviant when I am the one who married a fedayeen? Every mother has fears. I am a wife and a mother. And I am afraid for my husband and for my children. But this is God's will. I am afraid that something will happen to them before they finish their struggle, because I have always known that this route of action would lead either to martyrdom or to arrest.
Meeting resistance is directed by acclaimed journalists Molly Bingham and Steve Connors. In a video op-ed for the New York Times published Wednesday, they cite Pentagon reports between 2004 and 7 to claim 74% of attacks by Iraqi insurgents target U.S.-led occupation forces. They also cite a recent BBC-ABC poll, which found 100% of Iraqis polled disapproved of attacks on Iraqi civilians. However, a majority of them approved of attacking U.S. troops. One person in the film clarifies who legitimate targets of the Iraqi resistance should be.
First on the list of all legitimate targets are the military forces in Iraq. Those are the most important. The second most important are those who collaborate with them. There are some translators who try to help the people, and their job is just to explain the situation. But there are other translators who harm the people. There are policemen who do police's job, like chasing gangs, providing order and security. We leave them alone. But there are police who are collaborating with the Americans. As I told you, the American forces, the occupying forces, and their collaborators that work against the Iraqi people and against the Mujahideen, they are our legitimate targets. I hope America will send more forces. And we will send them back home in coffins.
Meeting Resistance opens in theaters in New York and in Washington, D.C. on Friday. Co-directors Steve Connors and Molly Bingham are the filmmakers who have worked in conflict zones around the world for over a decade. 2003 and 2004, they spent 10 months in Baghdad interviewing Iraqi resistance fighters. They join us now in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having us.
Molly, before this, you were kidnapped by Iraqi insurgents, is that right?
Actually, I was arrested by Saddam Hussein's security forces during the invasion and held for 8 days in Abu Ghraib on accusations of being a spy. So it's a little bit different than some of the later kidnappings and hostage takings that have happened in Iraq.
And you were in Abu Ghraib right before the U.S. forces came and took Baghdad.
That's right. I was in Abu Ghraib from March 25th to April 2nd, 2003.
What happened to you there?
I was held in a solitary cell. There were four other Westerners that were arrested at the same time.
Newsday reporter mm-hmm. and photographer.
That's right. We were all interrogated and accused of being spies. And luckily, we were all treated pretty well and released, deported to Amman, Jordan, on April 2nd.
And you went right back?
I took a few days off and came back to the States and then went back about 10 days later, yeah.
And the two of you have then, well, how did you do this? How did you find the resistance fighters to interview, Steve?
We just behaved as journalists. We went out and we just looked for people. I mean, we did have one slight advantage. Molly had been working on another story before we started on this. And a guy that she met in the course of doing that story afterwards said to Molly's translator, "I'm in the resistance." And he was just a regular guy. So what we did was, when we decided to do this story, you know, we were following events through, these very small scale attacks, and then through the summer, we decided to go back and do this story. So he was the first guy that we went to find, and it took us a few days, but we found him again.
Where?
In Adamir. It's a traditional district in northeastern Baghdad. often said to be a Ba'athist stronghold, but we didn't really find that.
But our sort of subtitle for the film is called Caffeine and Nicotine Poisoning in Baghdad, because really what we did is once we'd found the teacher who was that first person that I had met who admitted to being part of the resistance in May of 03, we went back to Adamia, we found him, and then we went pretty much every day for 10 months and sat in tea shops and smoked cigarettes and drank tea with Iraqis and listened to them talk about their understanding of the political situation. And throughout that period of time and over those conversations, often someone would emerge and they would talk to us later as we were leaving or talk to our translator and say, who are these journalists? What are they doing? Why are they spending so much time here? And we would explain that we were interested in understanding who the resistance is, who the insurgency is, who's behind this, what kind of people are you, what's your motivation, what leads you to this? And some people would say, well, I don't know anything about it, I'm not involved. And other people would say, I'm not going to talk to you. And then some, 12 actually, said, yes, I'm involved, and yes, I'll talk to you, and we would fix an appointment and do an interview. And six of those 12 we were able to interview repeatedly over that 10-month period of time.
Now, I read an interview, rather a speech that you gave in Louisville. You come from Louisville, Mali.
I do, yeah.
Where you talked about these people holding you responsible if anything were to happen to them. I mean, they have serious questions about who you are, even though they are doing these interviews. What did that mean, holding you responsible?
I think they wanted to impress upon us that this was not just an easygoing affair, that it wasn't just we went in and we sat down with them and we could walk away and think that we wouldn't be continually engaged with them or somehow responsible or it wasn't risky. All of the interviews really started out saying, you know, we hold you responsible, and if anything happens to us, our guys know where you live, they knew the hotel we were in, you know, we'll come kill you. And so in order to protect ourselves from that quite unreasonable expectation, because they were legitimate targets and legitimate people to be sought by the U.S. military at the time, of course, we decided that there were some things we didn't want to know. We didn't want to know their names, which is why they have these character names, the teacher, the traveler, the wife. We didn't want to know where they lived in case they got a knock on the door at the night. They knew that it wasn't us that had told about where they lived because we didn't know. We obscure their identity partly because they insisted on it, it was necessary to do the project, but also to protect us so that they knew that we weren't going and giving our tapes to the U.S. military intelligence.
I want to go to a remarkable clip in this film, and I'll read the translation. It has to do with the attempted bombing of Paul Wolfowitz when he went to Iraq. What time he comes in, what time he eats lunch, what time he we even had his room number. But at the moment that we attacked, he was in a different room because we hit him at 6 o'clock in the morning and he had a meeting at 6 o'clock.
This terrorist act will not deter us from completing our mission, which is to help the Iraqi people free themselves.
That was Paul Wolfowitz. The resistance guy says we were waiting for his visit. The playground is ours. We play on our own terms. Steve, did you interview the people who did the bombing?
No. This guy, the traveler in the film, was on the planning council, essentially. But he hadn't actually been involved in the planning of that operation, but it was reported back to him afterwards, and that's why we were able to get that story. I think we got the story, what, 3 or 4 weeks later, something like that.
And how did they say they did it? I mean, this was not only in the green zone, it was right in the heart.
Well, I mean, you've just been doing this story about Blackwater security. The contractor issue for the U.S. military is not just about the private security contractors. It's also about the people who provide the food, truck drivers, people who organize the payments and all this kind of stuff. And, of course, there are people who are locally hired. And can the people who are locally hired be trusted? What eventually happened was that apparently they had somebody inside the Rashid Hotel, and he knew what room Paul Wolfowitz was going to be in. It seems that an artillery officer adapted a generator, and they fired these quite poorly made Chinese manufactured rockets. But they killed two officers in that, killed two army officers in that attack.
At the time, Rashid was actually on the edge of the green zone. It was at the perimeter of the green zone. There was a park across the street. And it was only after that attack that they actually pushed out the boundary away from the Rashid Hotel so that it wasn't so vulnerable to attacks like
Paul
that.
Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Defense Secretary at the time. Molly Bingham, Steve Connors, stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
Shama here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are Molly Bingham and Steve Connors. Molly, U.S. journalist. Steve Connors, a British journalist. They co-directed this new film that's opening in Washington, D.C. and in New York this weekend called Meeting Resistance. When you were interviewing these people, the resistance fighters, Molly, did they tell you when they were about to attack something? You had footage of actual explosions.
Actually, that footage of explosions came from us working as journalists the way everyone else was in Baghdad. We responded to bombings that we heard around the city in the way everyone else did. When we were interviewing the Iraqis and the one Syrian who were engaged in the insurgency, we actually specifically didn't ask about tomorrow or this afternoon. We didn't go out on bombing attacks with them for quite a few reasons, but the most important of which, I think, is that the film is really about who they are and what their backgrounds are and what their motivation is. You can see the consequences of their actions every day on the news. And we just thought, given how complicated it was ethically in this particular conflict, I think quite unfairly, to be seen to be talking with the other side. We thought that if we had gone out with them on attacks, it would have overridden the entire understanding that we had come to by interviewing them and understanding who they are.
Could I just add to that? We were invited to go out with them. You know, they said, do you want to come out with us while we're attacking Americans? And, you know, I don't have the same ethical problems in many ways as Molly does, you know, because she's an American and I'm not. But ultimately, the decision came down to one thing, which was there was some important information in this film, and we didn't want to lose that to the to this criticism of us going out on attacks, which I've done in 10 conflicts, gone out on attacks with both sides. It's not, for most journalists, it's not a big deal.
Experts suggest the growing sectarian strife in Iraq has turned into a civil war. In Meeting Resistance, the characters are both Sunni and Shia. I want to play a clip featuring two characters in the film, the imam, who's a cleric from a mixed Sunni-Shia family and was suspected of being a Wahhabi and jailed by Saddam Hussein, and the Republican guard, who's Sunni and married to a Shia woman.
The Sunni and Shia are bound together by blood and family ties.
J
For example, I am married to a Shia. My sister's married to a Shia. I can't kill my own children's uncles or kill my wife, the mother of my children. This kind of sectarianism won't happen. So we hope there won't be a civil war, because the people who would fight in this war on either side are all relatives, like me. Half of my relatives are Shia, the other half are Sunni. It would be a catastrophe. And it would be the same for all Iraqi people. They're all related. They're neighbors. But the foreigner doesn't see these ties.
An excerpt of an astounding film just out now called Meeting Resistance. Molly Bingham, the speech you gave in your hometown of Louisville was entitled, you talk about being afraid of coming home to your own country. Explain that.
Well, if people can cast their minds back a little bit to the spring and summer of 2004, American citizens were not publicly discussing the problems that America was facing in Iraq and the things that weren't going well. It was still generally a discussion, if a discussion at all, about providing democracy and freedom to the Iraqis and how that was fine. What we had done by talking to the insurgents and interviewing them and making an effort to understand their motivation and who they are was something that I knew was going to be challenging to a broader American audience, and that I was maybe even be seen to be treason, you know, having committed treason by doing so. I completely disagree with that. I think this is what journalism is about. It's about understanding communities and bringing that back to a wider audience so that people can understand each other. Whether they agree with them or not is different, but that they can understand each other. So when I did come back into the country, the Vanity Fair had just run my article called Ordinary Warriors, which is based on the same reporting as Meeting Resistance. And I was very unsure as to what kind of response or reaction that would provoke. And I'm happy to say that I was needlessly anxious about it. There's, you know, been no problems or no kind of issues that I've had since that was published. And Steve and I have enjoyed being back here in the States. But I think that it has really changed since 2004, since basically Cindy Sheehan started insisting to that Bush explained to her what her son had died for, and since Murtha stood up and said that the war was a real problem. Those two things really changed the dynamic in the United States, and people started asking questions about what was happening in Iraq and why we were there.
If people want this film to play in their community, how do they make that happen?
You can go to our website, meetingresistance.org, and contact us through the website.
.com.
Sorry. Meetingresistance.com, forgive me. Meetingresistance.com, I'll say it one more time, and contact us through the website, and we would be happy to set up screenings and Q&As there.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us and for doing this film, Molly Bingham and Steve Connors, journalists who have co-directed the film Meeting Resistance. They went inside the Iraqi resistance for 10 months in Iraq. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Dokadus, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Carrie Mache, Robbie Karen, Kizzy Cox, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Special thanks to Elizabeth Press and Rebecca Silver, Haney Massoud, Samantha Chambly, John Randolph, Jose Miranda, Laura Chipley, Travis Collins, Vesta Bedars. I'll be in Montreal tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Leacock Auditorium at McGill University. You can go to our website to get our headlines, our transcripts, our video, and our audio podcasts, and to sign up for our daily digest, where you get our headlines and alerts of stories we're working on and stories we have done. Tell your friends about Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.